Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. This is the Discovery Edition. I am Michael, your host, here to tackle and discuss the final season of Star Trek Discovery with the discussion on the fourth episode of the final season titled Face the Strange. I think I've done that a couple times, sexually. It sounds like a title of a porno I once watched. Face the Strange.
The Strange. What kind of porno is that?
David, you never heard of Getting Some Strange? Like, there was a whole series of porns geared around that idea. It was a metaphor for... No, it wasn't. I'm not going to intellectualize porn, okay?
There's our new show, Mike. New show. Oh. Intellectualize porn.
Yes, we're going to be doing that during our hiatus from Star Trek discussions. We're going to get into the nuances of porn and the themes.
Watch, it's like our highest rated show of all time.
All the porn directors are finally going to like gravitate to podcasts. Like, these guys are good.
They understand
us. They finally understand the work we put in. It's all avant-garde. They finally get it. All right, so we have a lot to discuss, although I think this is going to be a shortened episode, only because, yes, there's a lot, but the episode was also fairly simple, and that's a good thing sometimes.
Yes.
Simplicity does not mean poor. Sometimes simple prevents the convoluted from happening. And in an episode like this, I feel like the best approach when you're dealing with time travel, yes, time travel again, there is a tendency to slip into those moments of convolution. Whereas here, taking a more simple approach, it worked to flesh out some very key aspects to Rayner.
Yes.
And our characters overall that also situate and frame our themes, our running themes about meaning a little differently, but also it parallels. It's in sync. For example, at the core of this episode, you get this idea about change and how change can be hard, but it's also how anything meaningful can happen.
Yes.
Without change, meaning does not form. It's a very interesting thought, David.
It's almost part of like the equation of what Burnham's overall story arc for this season is about, is trying to find meaning. So she has to figure out at least parts of the equation that makes the meaning of life.
Yeah.
And one of the things is adapting to change, because throughout all our lives, change is a constant. It's, you never have like,
well, if you were a Star Wars fan or a Star Trek fan, you are against change.
Yes. Ooh, that was a nice salvo there.
I'm firing shots at myself.
That was a nice salvo there that kind of blew up in your face. But like, but in a philosophical standpoint, change is inevitable. Change is constantly happening. It just depends on how we react to that change. Yeah. And what, how does that mold us, and how does that change our meaning, or how does that bring us to our meaning in life or in our purpose?
Well, it also contextualizes meaning. The beautiful parts of this episode dealing with Burnham specifically, the time travel, this is why it worked, because the time travel, which is simply a writing device, this is okay. This type of use of time travel is fine because it isn't about creating some gimmick. You know, hey guys, let's celebrate and go through notes of nostalgia as we visit the past, or let's, you know, create some convoluted episodes just for shits and giggles. This episode was about creating connections to the bigger story arc and our characters' current mental states. When you have Burnham confronting herself from the past, it generates or internalizes reflection. And that's really the point of this episode at its heart. Now, I will say that the opening of the episode, I was getting a little nervous. A lot of it has to do with the fact that I didn't really care for the last episode. So I was already a little on edge, Dave. I was hoping that episode 3 was not a trend and it was more just an aberration. It was a mistake. And as it turns out, this episode is far stronger. It's right back where it needs to be in terms of overall quality. But there was a moment, the opening 9 minutes made me cringe a bit because you started in a very non-linear fashion. You started with, what was it, 18 hours prior.
I knew when I first saw that, like, oh, this is going to very irritate me and Mike when we actually talk about this, because one of the... Apparently, it's a writing crutch now for a lot of writers, Mike.
I fucking hate it.
They want to constantly go 18 hours earlier.
And it wasn't even needed.
In the past.
We didn't even need the 18 hours earlier. Yes. You could have just started the episode there. Why confuse the fuck out of people?
Especially when it didn't even deal with the two main characters.
No, it didn't matter. So you have 18 hours, then you have present. And then you actually jump through time.
Yes.
All in 9 minutes. That made me nervous at first. I was like, oh my God. It wasn't great. But then coming back from the teaser, everything straightens out and the episode becomes actually a very strong installment of the season so far. David, what are your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts of this one, I was actually pleasantly surprised with the bounce back from the last episode. The last episode to me was a really bad put together episode of Discovery.
Was it a bounce back, David, or a resuscitation?
I want to say a bounce back because remember, last episode, was badly executed, but there were concepts that they were building off of that I'm like going, okay, I agree with their concepts and I like them.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the execution was much better contained. Yeah. And it goes into like what you alluded to earlier is like, this was a much tighter story script.
Mm-hmm.
And this, for me, I like that because you bring consistency. You bring in basically, if you are more coherent and not meandering all over the place, this is where basically everything kind of starts to gel together. I was like you. I was like, oh God, it's going to be a time travel episode. So it's going to bounce everywhere and it's going to meander all over the place in different time frames. But instead, they really harped on the fact that, yes, this is a time travel episode, but time travel is not the important part of this episode. What's happening to the characters and the discussion and the dialogue that is happening between the characters is more important. Everything else is just flashy, right? Or right around them. Okay. And especially since you essentially have your three best actors in this episode, just knocking it out of the park and carrying the episode. You have Burnham, you have Stamets, and you have Rainer.
Don't forget Jet Reno.
Oh, God. And Jet Reno.
Dude, why does she own every scene?
Yeah.
Am I right, though?
But there you go. You have four veteran, veteran's probably not the best way to put it, but four actors giving the top of their craft, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you listen to our last episode, I felt really bad being really critical on the actors in the prior episode, because I really felt the acting really brought the episode down.
Yeah.
Because I didn't believe in their dialogue. I didn't believe in their characters. I didn't believe in their motivations. Here, it's quite the opposite. Now I believe more in Burnham. I believe more in Stamets and Rainer and Jet. And because of what they did, now I feel I'm leaving that episode much more believing in where they're going. instead of, you know, in the last episode where it's like, okay, where the hell are you going with Gray and Adira? Apparently nowhere. Okay. Where are you going with Saru and the president? Apparently nowhere. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But you are right. This episode is a bounce back. For
it's a bounce
sure.
back.
And they did focus on characters, you know, in order to, I guess, flesh them out a bit. And I will say, David, I've had a lot of problems with Stamets through the years. He's probably my least favorite Star Trek character just because he's always miserable. He's just very unhappy. And I don't know if that's the way he plays the part or if that's just the actor himself and mm-hmm. he can't help it. And I feel bad if that's the case. But it's just a character that I've always struggled with for various reasons. This episode, though, was so redeeming. He was so good. You saw a side of Stamets that we don't see very often. Someone that isn't morose. Someone that isn't rude and condescending.
Condescending.
You know, kind of, the arrogance that usually permeates. He was a normal, likable person in this episode, and it did so much for me on various levels. And I think it was really smart to do something like this for the final season. Now, please don't misinterpret or misconstrue what I'm saying. I don't dislike the character. Stamets is a character that I've struggled with, but throughout the last 5 seasons, he has had some great moments. Oh, yeah. And then there's been less than stellar moments. And it has nothing to do with him per se, the actor. His acting's fine. It's just the roles they've been writing for him.
Yes.
They haven't been super great at times. But there have been those high moments. And this episode is one of those high moments. It did a lot for its character. And we needed to do that in a show that it's in its 5th season, its final season, and they were able to really shape the episode in a way that it conveyed the much needed information that helped push the season forward, but also it created a lot of levity. It took us out of the dark existentialism that we've been enmeshed in since the first episode of the season, and allowed us to see some light.
Yeah.
And it's really smart because they paralleled this levity with the acknowledgement, or I guess the realization that Rayner had.
Yeah.
By the end of the episode, where he understood the reason for the familiarity amongst the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like that as well. That's something that you and I have addressed for a long time, mostly in jokes, because I don't think it creates any problems in writing. This isn't a quality problem. But you and I have always made jokes that this is the most touchy-feely crew in any Star Trek series. There's not a lot of professionalism. There's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of disregard for the chain of leadership. And they actually addressed that in this episode. And we actually have theorized and speculated the same reasons that they use to excuse that is the same thing we've been saying. They've traveled through time together. The only thing they know is each other.
Is each other.
And that's the connection. And that's why there is those aspects, or are those aspects of familiarity. And the way they use that to contrast with Rayner. And if you didn't catch this, this is them answering fans' complaints, mind you, because you have Rayner, who does embody the stereotypical, or the archetypal, I should say, Star Trek captain. He does.
Yeah.
And then you have this notion of change. You throw that in there. And you also have this idea that the old archetype has to contend with change.
With change.
Okay, we got that. Now we're going to explain why this crew is different. I really like the steps they took to bridge the difference in command structure.
Yes, because like that's the whole thing with Rayner that I was really hoping they would go with, is because don't turn Rayner into the archetypical Discovery evil character. He's an outsider of the crew. He's going to be the guy who turns on the crew, right? No. We're going to make Rayner the outsider, yes, but also an outsider that's going to understand this crew. that's going to work with this crew.
They're operating at both a practical level and also a meta level.
And a meta level, yeah. And that's what I really liked about... I was really worried with the handling of Rainer's character, because a lot of the criticism of, you know, Discovery is like, it's a woke show. A character like Rainer, who harkens back to like Captain Kirk and Spock and Picard, those type of captains, does not fit well. Archer doesn't fit well in this type of Star Trek show.
Reggie, can you imagine Kirk?
Oh, Kirk would be having sex with everybody. Oh.
No, he would. He'd be canceled on this show.
He'd be canceled.
How dare you look at my breasts, sir?
Well, it's very hard. It's hard to miss. It's hard to miss. As he's just glaring at Tilly the whole time.
There's something large in my pants.
Would you mind bringing me to sick bay?
Why? Why the sick bay?
Mostly, did you ever know
Culber's there? Are you trying to write your own slash fiction here?
On a side note, most of the action in the original series tends to happen in the sick bay.
Yeah, well,
I'm just saying. So, but regardless of where, you know, Starfleet has their sex, the way they handled Rainer in this episode was, it really galvanized my belief that this character is going to be my favorite for the season. They're not going to mess it up, basically, because I know I could see the direction they're taking him.
Yeah. And also it's doing what we had thought it was going to do. The inclusion of Rainer. We had said, I believe off air, we spoke more in depth about the purpose of this character. And we had, I believe, conveyed a little bit of that in our first episode discussion, that when you cast someone new in the middle of a series for a major role, it can't just be simply because we need someone new. They're doing it to expand the possibility of the story. When you introduce a character like this, it's because you're going to use them as a writing device. And since the first episode, David, he has been used as more than just a contrastive device, but definitely as a way to contrast and bridge certain notions that Star Trek fans have yet to come to terms with Discovery, but also goes beyond that. It's not just an answer to Star Trek fans. It's also a interesting way to create, I don't want to say contrive, because contrive is a negative, yeah. It has negative connotations, but for lack of a better word at this moment, let's say contrive. Let's create. To create new divisions, more interesting scenarios for characters, things that might not work as well with the standing crew. So let's bring in a wild card and see what this particular character will do organically. Many times when you fully develop a wild card character and you just simply throw him into the writing room and say, guys, have at it. This is his bio. This is what he's about. This is his personality. And then you hand it off to the writing room. Let's see what you can do with this.
Yeah.
It creates a new dynamic. And all shows need to breathe new life. Every Star Trek series has done it, usually around season 4, Jerry Ryan for Voyager, mm-hmm. Michael Dorn for Deep Space Nine, the aspects of the Borg and Picard's assimilation in TNG. Those are all moments that change the dynamic of the show for the good, for the better. Enterprise did it as well with the Zindi. It changed the dynamic of the show. So when you have a character like Rainer, there's a purpose, and they're using him damn good. Actually, damn good. They're using him very well.
There you go.
So far, it's working. Whatever strategy they had in mind, it is working in a big way, because not only are you able to do different types of stories, but you can also do scenarios like this episode where you have the discussion or you're brokering the discussion on change.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the core of the episode, yes, it was about aligning Rainer a little bit more with the crew, but also knowing that, yes, this is the Burnham show. In a lot of ways, it's also to show how much has changed since the first season. Now it makes sense why Sonequa Martin-Green said that even though they didn't know this was the final season, there was a bit of finality to this season when they were shooting it. That she felt like they went full circle.
And that right there is what has me really excited for Discovery for this final season, because we are getting Burnham's story completely full circle.
Yes.
Where it's kind of like that moment in the very beginning when Burnham is looking at Rainer and telling him, this is my ship. You have to do things my way. And Rainer looks at her, well, what happens if my way is better? And it at that moment for me, it brought it full circles to the beginning of season one, where Burnham is looking at Giorgio and saying, well, my way is the right way.
Yes.
And what does she do? She causes the war between the Klingons and the Federation.
So do you see then that Rainer was doubling up, like meaning the writers were using him to double up on intent? They
exactly.
were also using him as a mirror of reflection for Burnham to for notice Burnham. How much she has changed.
She has changed. And it's like, tying it all together with Burnham's journey this season with what is my purpose? What is the meaning of life? And then coming full circle with her past decisions, I think was a genius move. And in a lot of ways, I know I've always criticized the use of time travel. I thought time travel is a crutch. Real good writers should not use time travel and in their stories. But here I have to eat my crow and say, time travel is an essential thing to this type of story that they're telling, because you have to make Burnham and us as the audience remember the things of the past that has happened.
What also shows that we always talk about the human condition when it comes to Star Trek. Well, change is a part of the human condition. Understanding change, that's how you progress. That's mm-hmm. how you grow. If you don't change, there is no progress, which then goes against the very notion of Gene Roddenberry's whole idea of Star Trek about progressive change, about being a better person. And in a lot of ways, that's what they were positioning or leveraging in this episode, was showing the change and the growth of Burnham
mm-hmm.
and how she's changed and how even things would have gone completely different if she was not the person she is today. By showing that she's matured and she has grown and she's become a far better leader, it then allows us to understand what the messaging is for Rainer as well. That
yes.
times have changed. The galaxy isn't in a state of panic. The burn has been discovered. They know how to bypass those issues. And now we need to find a new way moving forward. And also, it's a metaphor for a lot of what's going on in today's society, dealing with change. There's a lot of things that are happening very quickly in society.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, far too fast. Humans have difficulty with change. And the fact that things are changing, boom, 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 a mile a minute, it's created a state of existentialism within society.
Yeah.
A lot of us are afraid of change. And when change happens too fast, we sometimes no longer know where we fit in. And that's why this episode is so strong, because it does so many things at so many different levels.
And in a very tight and concise script. That it's just
simple,
like
simple script.
And this is where I basically go, where was this? Where was this? Where was this from there? But besides that, you know, complaint from the last episode, that's the thing that I'm basically like going is like with Rainer, the sad part to me is the fact that this is this final season and we'll never get to see Rainer at the end of this.
Well, don't say that. We might be able, listen, that character and Keith Callum, I always forget his name. What is his name? Keith Callum. Rennie.
Yeah.
Callum Keith Rennie. Callum Keith Rennie. David, they better find a reason to use him again, because he's too good to let him go after one season. If they don't bring him back in Starfleet Academy or some other rendition of Star Trek. Oh my God,
that'd be hilarious. Rainer in the Academy.
Teaching kids.
Teaching children.
That'd be awesome.
Just yelling at people.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, David, this episode did a lot of things right. We also got a little bit on Maul and Lack, which I'm not quite sure how we're supposed to feel about them yet. It seems like they're trying to create a little bit of sympathy or empathy for Maul.
Particularly with Maul.
Yeah, because you have Burnham, which we didn't talk about during our last discussion, knows Lack. It's the last, one of the last surviving people of his world.
Yes.
That's an interesting aspect, and it's a great way, if they are able to bring her around, it's a great way to bring closure to Book's story.
Yeah.
Because here's a man who thinks he's alone, and he discovers someone else, and he's no longer alone. That would be an interesting way to bring a little bit of closure and finesse to his story. So we'll see where it goes, but I don't really care for these characters yet. I feel like they're kind of just bad people.
Well, that's the interesting thing to me, is the fact that for four episodes now, Maul and Locke, their motivations have not really been fleshed out. The only motivation we have is like they're after a big score. That's it.
And are these people that short-sighted? That's another thing. They're willing to sell this device, this technology, to the Breen, apparently. Are these people we really want to root for? People who are willing to sell a...
exactly.
A weapon of mass destruction to the Breen?
And that's the thing that I'm like trying to... I'm keeping my opinions open still on those two characters, because we do have some room left to figure out how they fit in this puzzle. Mm-hmm. But like...
Maybe we're not supposed to have sympathy for them, but it does seem like they're trying to create it. Right?
It does. Yeah. It does, especially with Book, because we're supposed to feel sorry for Book when he basically sees this person for the first time, realizes, hey, this is like, I'll never forget the one thing that had me slightly eye roll in the one episode where he says, she's like my missing half sister. Okay. Okay. You don't know this person, but. Okay. I just did I make your eyes roll twice? Yeah,
they fell out of my eye sockets.
But like but that's an important narrative for Book's character, especially since coming off of the last season where he is the last of his kind.
I am the last one.
I am the last one.
He's like Dragonheart.
Dragonheart.
That's a deep cut.
But like with Book's narrative for this
entire season. Did I break you, David?
It did, because now I got Sean Connery playing in my head. But like with Book's narrative for the entire season, it has to tie at least now to Locke. And if we don't find any sympathy for that character, how are we going to actually feel sorry for Book? Or how are we going to understand Book's motivation? It might even backfire and turn Book into a non-likable character.
I am curious as to how Book became one of the lead characters. I like him.
I do too.
I don't disagree with the idea, but when you choose to sideline other long-standing characters like Awoshkun and Detmer, and some of our bridge crew.
Mm-hmm.
I got a question. Why?
Question why?
It feels a little weird that he's taken the forefront, even in the marketing. It's Burnham, Book, and the Doctor at the top of the marketing. Yes. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, I love the Doctor. He's actually one of my favorite characters in the show. He's such a good actor, an interesting character. Oh, I mean, at first he wasn't in the first season. I don't think he was meant to be, but moving into the second season, he became way more interesting and more of a, and had more of a pivotal role in the series. But it is strange when you look at the marketing and the three of them are in the forefront, because the show's never really been built around them per se, but it seems like it now has. Well, right? Even this season, it seems to be about Culber, because I know Kurtzman also said in an interview, I believe it was Kurtzman, or it might have been Wilson Cruz himself, I cannot remember at the moment, but the point is that the Trill experience is supposed to not be done.
Yeah.
It's supposed to have lasting ramifications throughout the season.
On Culber, yeah.
So it looks like the season is geared around him a lot as well. So maybe that's why the marketing was done that way. But I also scratch my head and wonder, like, how did this happen in the series where the three of them became like the focus?
Yeah. And this is something that,
which I don't have a problem with that, but is that, was there a consensus? Was there a poll out there? Like, I'm being serious. I know they did that with other Star Trek shows where they changed the dynamic when they realized fans were more drawn to certain characters. So they then would proceed to write the shows around those characters. They did it with TNG, with Data, and Picard. Essentially, Data and Picard were really the focus of most of TNG's greatest stories. And the movies were always about Picard and Data.
Yeah.
Look at Picard season one. Data.
Data.
Look at Picard season three. Data.
Data.
And Picard, obviously. Deep Space Nine, they have done that too. So it's not a new concept, but it does... I wonder if there is if there's a poll out there, because I don't really hear a lot of people advocating for more Dr. Culbert.
Well, that's the
I'm here for it, but I don't know if I've seen that. Have you?
That's the weird thing about Star Discovery that I feel is like Discovery has, since day one, has always tried to be different than any of the other Star Treks, any of the other Star Trek series. So any of the atypical Star Trek tropes or idioms that you'd expect, Discovery tries to go against, which is like the whole, there's always two or three main people per series, right? You know, whether you have the original series, it's always been Kirk, Spock, McCoy. TNG, it's Picard, Data, and then you always have maybe Worf or maybe someone like a third person, one of the crew to basically step up in every of the seasons, but it's always Picard and Data. In like Discovery, every season it seems to change. Burnham's main focus,
but the secondary
and third always changes. Different. It always changes. Like first season it was supposed to be Saru. Oh no, it was actually supposed to be Tyler and Georgiou, right?
And Lorca.
But then like second season you get Georgiou, Burnham, Saru,
Spock, Pike.
Oh, Spock and Pike.
Tilly's also been at Tilly's the forefront there until last year, and this year seems like she's in the fore. She's not being forgotten, but she, but it's not really about her.
If you were to look at Discovery, and you would say, who are the three main original characters of Discovery that we can actually pinpoint, say they're the quote-unquote heart or backbone of Discovery, I would have to say it'd have to be Burnham, Tilly, and Saru.
Correct. Yes, that's exact. When I think Star Trek Discovery, those are the three faces that pop up.
But for some strange reason, every single season, it's something different. Whether it's like, particularly you pointed out this season, it's Burnham, Book, and Culbert.
Well, Book was there too in the third and fourth season, but it wasn't.
He wasn't front and center. He wasn't front and center.
It loosely revolved around him, but he wasn't the star. He wasn't number two in the call sheet. It seems like he's now number two or three in the call sheet.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting change. I would love to know behind the scenes why they did that. Maybe there's just a chemistry there between Taniqua Martin Green and the actor that plays Book.
David Ayala, I think his name is.
Yeah, maybe that's the reason why, because I know those things sometimes dictate changes. You know, if there's chemistry that really works between the two, and by the request of one of the actors, like, listen, it really works well between us, then you'll see some of those changes. So who knows? Those are things that we probably will never find out about until well after the show has come to an end and you hear people at conventions or
that's where the real stories come from.
Yeah. Or film scholars have started to do some research into the production of individual seasons. That typically doesn't happen for about 10 or 15 years though. So we'll see if we ever find out. Overall though, David, I will say this episode was very, very strong. There was something I had a question about, David, that is a little weak that I had to bring up. I'm not a big fan of just creating new ideas that are loosely attached to assumptions. Stamets lives outside of time because of the tardigrade DNA.
Yes.
I feel like that was simply floated in this episode so that they can obviously make the excuse of bringing him into the episode in this way. Have you heard them say this before?
This seemed pretty new.
Because if you look at the past episodes,
it's never brought up.
No, but there's an argument. That's why I'm saying it's assumptive. Like you can go through the past episodes
and say,
okay, I guess that would make sense.
Yeah.
But that statement is quite the statement for never, ever truly. There were allusions, let's say, but never stating something like this. It feels a little forced.
It feels just a little bit forced. If it came out of nowhere, I would say that, yes, I would agree with you. However, because of what Stamets
has been through,
yeah. And if you've watched Discovery since season one, you can put the assumptions together and say, okay, this makes sense that this would be as a byproduct of what's happened to Stamets thus far. Because since day one, They've tackled already the science at the very beginning of how the tardigrades affect time and how the mycelial network works, and it's how the mycelial network is outside of time and how that affects everything, and that science. So because we know Stamets was hooked up to the drive quite essentially throughout like a couple of the seasons, it would make sense that his DNA would be altered.
Yeah.
Because of his connection to the I forgot what the drive was called.
The spore drive.
Spore drive.
Yeah. Okay. So you're okay with that. You're telling me that it's not that big. Okay. That's what I needed. I needed to hear another thought on it because I wasn't upset at it. It didn't irk me, but I did notice that it felt like, okay, I've never heard that before. But like I said, there were allusions that you can, looking back, you can seemingly retrospectively see those potential allusions to that
concept.
And because of that, I wasn't overly disgruntled with it. However, I am nervous and cautious when it comes to those types of lines that are just dropped.
It does, because like you have to actually start asking yourself, well, if Stamets was actually, and this is what I thought, because I thought it was a cool little assumption you can make. But the problem with assumptions, Mike, when you do this in science fiction is it leaves it open to other questions. Because like if Stamets is infected if his DNA was affected by the spore drive, I'm not saying the entire crew would be infected because Stamets was physically connected to the spore drive. There are characters in Discovery where you're like going, well, they're connected to the mycelial network also because, and this is what dawned on me at the end was Culbert's body was created in the mycelial network.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, so shouldn't Culbert be having the same issues as Stamets?
Yeah, I see that.
And like, see, that's the problem with that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they showed both Stamets and Culbert dealing with that, then I'd say, oh, okay, that explains that.
Yeah. Yeah, it just creates unnecessary questions.
But it's definitely a small nitpick because, like, luckily,
it doesn't ruin the episode.
It doesn't ruin the episode.
And even though there is a perceived, let's say, narrative gap there, potentially, it It's all right. I don't think it's a deal breaker. Although if you litter your seasons with those types of things,
that's when it can add up.
Yeah. But that's why something like this would have worked better, Dave. And these things are usually mapped out. It's called, you know, breaking a story. Usually if you want to have something like this play a major plot function, then what you need to do is introduce this concept earlier on. So in episode one, they should have found a clever way to say something about Stamets' DNA and how his connection to the mycelial network has made him have a different perception on time.
Yeah.
If they would have said something like that in passing, it would have been far better when they dropped this aspect on us. That's why planning a story is so important.
Comes down to the writing room.
You cannot write episode to episode without planning strategically what's going to be a part of each episode. It's a little bit like that concept, Chekhov's gun. And I think we've talked about this in other discussions. It's a narrative principle that states that every element in a story must be necessary and irrelevant elements should be removed. For example, if a writer features a gun in a story, there must be a reason for it, such as being fired sometime later in the plot. Now, this is a little different than the situation we have, but it's the same guiding principle.
Yeah.
If you're going to use something, it needs to be introduced. Let me rephrase this. If you're going to use something that's going to be vital to the plot and the direction in the story, it should be introduced earlier on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just in a short bit.
Yeah. All right. So that pretty much is the end of the discussion. As I said, it was a very simple episode, very effective, though. It did help smooth out some of Rayner's edges. He now understands the dynamic a bit better, and he is striving to fit in because of the experience, which I thought was smart. That's one of my favorite things shows do, is when you need to create rapport between characters, throw them in a situation where they can't escape from each other, but they need to rely on each other.
Yeah.
That's usually the easiest way to bring commonality to two different characters. And it was effective and it worked well. I will say this is a very strong episode. It's a 91% for me, which is a huge leap from
the last episode. Yeah. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I gave this episode an 88 because this was a definite jump from the bad taste that I had from episode 3. So without those little assumptions there, I really do feel that this was a really great episode of Discovery.
Yeah. All right, Dave, this brings us to the end. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.